almost 5 minutes. Given the proximity of the epicenter, people along the coast will only have minutes to seek higher ground before a tsunami reaches shore. Given the size and duration of the quake, damaged infrastructure and buildings will make it difficult to impossible in some low-lying areas for any sort of mass evacuation to occur in time. Another scientist estimates a tsunami triggered by a quake of this magnitude and proximity to shore as being anywhere from 20 to 50 feet tall, and the wave would be kilometers long, so that the initial and sudden surge in sea level would continue for the entire length and duration of that wave, pushing all that water inland. She suggests residents immediately seek areas that are 80 to 100 feet above sea level. The 50-foot-tall bluffs along the coastline likely won't be a safe enough height. The lead newscaster interrupts the split-screen discussion, announcing a tsunami has indeed struck the Oregon shoreline, and they have video footage from Cannon Beach. He warns the images they are about to show are disturbing. The video plays. A shaky, handheld, wide shot of the beach, which is dotted with large rocks jutting out like shark fins from its flat sand and shallow, low-tide water. The rocks are as black as shadow, giving them an uncanny, otherworldly feel, like looking at frozen pieces of space-time. One rock dwarfs the others, looming in the center of the shot, big enough to be its own mountain, big enough that it should sink through the sand and to the center of the earth. Adrian says, "Shit, that's the Goonies rock. Remember that movie?" She smiles widely and stares at Eric and Andrew, apparently waiting for some sort of response or validation from them. "Come on. You've all seen that movie, yeah? The kid solves a clue with that big fucking rock or the rocks around it?" "It's called Haystack Rock," Sabrina says, "almost 250 feet tall. I was there last summer. My best friend from college lives in Portland. It's a beautiful spot." A blast of wind crackles through the speakers. There are people still on the beach, some of them a great distance away, and some at the rocks and the eerily receded water. They are small digital avatars of actual people, blips of bathing suit colors on blurry legs. A guy off camera, impossible to tell how far away he is, shouts, "Come on, let's go!" The owner of the smartphone, a woman, says, "I know. Okay, we're going. I promise." But she isn't going. She and the camera stay in their same spot. Adrian walks into the middle of the room, points at the TV, and says, "Holy shit. This is what I saw." Leonard nods his head and narrows his eyes, but in an exaggerated manner, as though he's pretending to listen, pretending to deeply consider what she says. Sabrina backs away from the TV and mumbles something Eric thinks is, "Not what I saw." Adrian laughs. "I saw this exact fucking thing, and I thought I was crazy, you know, because of the Goonies rock. I really did. There was one night last week I stayed up all night drinking black tea, and I was out of milk, but I kept drinking it because I didn't want to go back asleep and see the goddamn Goonies rock get swamped again." She looks excitedly around the room. "Only crazy people keep having tidal wave nightmares with people getting swallowed up at the fucking Goonies rock, right?" She laughs again, demonstrating what her going crazy would sound like. "Love that stupid movie. Still do, no matter what people say about it now." As Adrian talks, they're shouting on and off the screen, and a flash of an angry guy wearing black sunglasses and a white tank top. The camera finally starts moving away from Haystack Rock, which slowly recedes into the horizon, a horizon growing in height and coming toward the camera. There are faraway, small-in-volume screams that sound canned, and loud ones that are close, that could be in the cabin with them, and there are cries and shouts of "Run!" and "Help!" A blue wall rises, its darker blue frosted with white, contrasts with the indifference of the light blue sky. Those small digital blips of people down by the rocks are running, but they are slow. Some of the small blips are smaller than others. Sabrina walks in front of Gwen, blocking her view of the TV.
Do you want to play in your room instead of watching this? Did you bring any toys? I'd like to see them. Will you show me?
Leonard says, Sabrina, not now. You know they have to see. She snaps at him. Nope. Gwen doesn't. She does not have to see anything more. Sabrina, she's seen enough, don't you think? You can let them watch, fine. But she's done. I'm done. And I'm taking her out of here.
Come on, Gwen. Show me your room and your toys, please.
She tries a smile, but it crumbles, unable to hold up the rest of her face. She reaches out a hand toward Gwen. Shouts and screams coming from the TV speakers grow louder, as if making up for lost horrors. Eric says,
Maybe that's a good idea, Gwen.
He says it before thinking, and wishes he could take it back as soon as he says it. Gwen says, No, I'm staying, shakes her head violently and leans into Andrew.
You're not going anywhere. I love you, Andrew says. What's happening on TV doesn't prove or mean anything. But don't watch, okay?
Haystack Rock shrinks into the rising ocean, momentarily fulfilling a geological pledge made eons ago. The shark fin rocks are gone. The people blips who were running up the beach are gone. And so is most of the beach. The sunlight flashes brightly into the cabin again. And Eric is washed away. 4. Andrew and Eric. After Sabrina takes the remote and finally changes the channel from the coverage of the devastating Northern Pacific earthquake and tsunami to the Cartoon Network, Andrew suggests Gwen sit with Eric. He says it's because Eric needs some Gwen time right now, which is true. But Andrew also wants to be left alone, to work at the restraints without her leaning on or otherwise drawing attention to him. Gwen watches Adventure Time while sitting cross-legged on top of Eric's feet. In this episode, Lumpy Space Princess argues with her parents and screams about a spilled can of beans. Adventure Time will later become other cartoons, some Andrew and Eric have seen before, and some they haven't. During a commercial, Leonard says to them,
You will be given the same choice again. This choice is a gift. Not all gifts are easy to accept. The most important gifts are often the ones we wish with all our hearts to refuse. Tomorrow morning, you can make the difficult, selfless choice of sacrifice and save the world. Or, you can again choose for the clock to move another minute closer to permanent midnight, like it did this afternoon. For the rest of today and tonight, we'll tend to your needs within reason. And we'll otherwise leave you be, let you reflect and talk it over with each other.
He repeats this without pause. The retelling matches word for word, inflection for inflection. Further shaken by the horrific and uncannily prophesied images broadcast on the news, and their sounds, the immutable roar of the surging ocean, the screams crackling through the speakers, tin-canned, and somehow more authentic because their volume and desperation could not be reproduced digitally without modulation. And with the last of the fading afternoon sunlight forcing his eyes closed, Eric again worries at the memory of the figure in light he did or didn't see. Andrew says, We don't need to wait until tomorrow morning, and we're never going to change our minds. Leonard retreats into the kitchen. He opens the refrigerator and cabinets. He asks if anyone is hungry. No one answers. He says,
I'm going to grill up the chicken in a little bit. We all need to eat. You have to eat. No one makes good decisions when they are hungry. Sabrina asks if anyone has seen a mop and or floor cleaner. She roots around under the kitchen sink and emerges with a plastic bottle of amber liquid. She soon finds a yellow bucket and a large green sponge in the cellar. She scrubs the blood-stained floor with mixed results. Adrian stacks the three homemade weapons next to the wood-burning stove. She spends more than an hour cleaning them with warm water, a dab of dishwashing detergent, and hand towels. After, she rescues the kitchen table from the edge of the basement stairs and puts it back in its old spot. One of the legs is bent and loose, making the table wobbly. She jams the book Eric was reading, the one about a kid going missing, under the leg for stability. It's not the right size. She tries again with Andrew's book of critical essays, and it's a better fit. Andrew and Eric remain tied to their chairs throughout the afternoon and into early evening. The only constants are the cartoons and the flurry of cabin cleaning and kitchen prep. They do not speak, other than to check in with Wen. Are you hungry? Are you okay? Do you need to go to the bathroom? Do you want a nap? Take a break from watching TV? You just tell us, okay? We love you. They mostly retreat inside their heads. Panic and their varying discomforts from injuries and the physical trial of a constant sitting position within restraints interrupt their inner dialogues, their increasingly hopeless plans and fantasies of escape. The sun sinks into the forest beyond the front door of the west-facing cabin. The gaudy glow of the television screen is the only source of light, until the three others turn on the lamps and light fixtures. The wagon wheel bulbs above their heads are tinted yellow with age. Cobwebs link the bulbs and the spokes of the wooden frame. The weaker artificial light is trapped inside the cabin. It quickly grows too dark outside to see Redmond from within the glow of the common room. The color and the topography of the blanket cover for his body are not visible, and there's only a vague sense of something there, dumbly occupying space on the deck. It's as though he isn't there at all, like a decaying cultural memory of a deep, dark historical past, a something that happened to someone else. Those someone else's are always so hapless, aren't they? One we actively wish to forget, even as we claim to acknowledge the danger of forgetting. Leonard announces he is going to turn on the grill and cook the chicken. He says it like he's reading the first steps of the how-to manual for the bizarre evening ahead. He walks over to Wen and gently plucks her from Eric's feet. She does not resist. Andrew and Eric shout and tell Leonard to leave her alone, to not touch her. Responses as automatic as they are feckless. Leonard says she will be fine, and she is just going to sit with him on the couch while her dads use the bathroom to wash up for dinner. Then he asks Wen if them going to the bathroom is a good idea, and shouldn't everyone wash their hands before they eat? She is adrift on Leonard's lap, positioned like a ventriloquist's dummy. She squirms and slouches, obviously trying to slide off his lap. He readjusts her. He tells Andrew and Eric that they will not try anything stupid while their legs are untied. He says, "We've reached a critical point, the point of no return, and you must cooperate." It's less what he says, but how he says it. Adrian retrieves the dual-ended weapon, the largest one, the one that cratered Redmond's chest, and leans it against the couch next to Leonard and Wen. Sabrina and Adrian untie Andrew's legs first. Andrew makes a joke about needing more than his feet to go to the bathroom. Sabrina says she will help, and, "I'm a nurse, and I've seen it all." Standing up from the chair is difficult, and his nearly 40-year-old legs are practically numb. A painful rush of pins and needles swarms his lower extremities. Eric has the same experience when he first stands, and he has to move slower as the act of standing fuzzes his head with light and heat. Both men, their hands tied behind their backs, Have a turn at shuffling feebly into the bathroom. The door remains open, with Adrian standing in the doorway as a guard. They are positioned in front of the toilet and suffer the indignity of Sabrina loosening their shorts and underwear to allow them to urinate. Leonard keeps a one-sided dialogue going about him and Wen having a nice visit together on the couch. He asks her questions. He pretends she answers him to continue the conversation. Both men, at certain points during their odyssey to and from the bathroom, consider running and or bashing themselves into Sabrina and or kicking Adrian. Both men decide this isn't the time, not while the others are at their most vigilant. They do not want to believe Leonard would hurt Wen, despite his clearly being more than capable of extreme violence. They rationalize an escape attempt will make more sense the next time they are allowed to use the bathroom. Having coordinated this successful, uneventful maiden trip, the three others can't help but slacken their guard just a little bit the next time, or the time after that. After they are returned and retied to their chairs, they notice the ropes wound around their hands and wrists have slackened. Or perhaps that's wishful thinking. No. Their body's change of position and leverage, their movement, they're walking across the cabin and reshaping themselves into the tighter space of the bathroom alongside Sabrina, has to have loosened the ropes. They can feel it. Leonard clumsily washes and preps the boneless chicken breasts before Adrian takes over. She forgoes the deck floodlighting, insisting she doesn't need it, yelling at Leonard until he shuts the exterior lights off, and works in the near-total dark. She says the grill sucks, and she can't be judged by what such an inferior product produces. The smell is simply exquisite, and Sabrina says so with a smile on her face as she prepares a large bowl of garden salad. Leonard sets the kitchen table. 4 plates, 4 forks, and 4 plastic cups. Adrian ducks through the broken sliders with a platter of steaming grilled meat, warning the room with, "Watch out, hot stuff!" And she barks at Leonard to shut the screen door behind her before they let in every moth and mosquito in New Hampshire. There is already a gaggle of winged insects swarming the wagon wheel light fixture, their bodies relentlessly pinging against the bulbs. Eric spies 2 thick black flies, wondering if they are the same ones he saw earlier, and when they smack into a bulb, Eric is convinced the wagon wheel sways with the impact. Their buzzing is a low hum, like a chant. Leonard takes Wen's hand, and with a small, gentle tug, she stands and follows him to the kitchen table. She sits on the far side, next to Leonard, and facing her parents. Sabrina made her a cup of chocolate milk with chocolate kisses she melted in the microwave. On Wen's plate are a small pile of bite-sized pieces of chicken, and a mini-salad composed of lettuce, 2 cherry tomatoes, and 3 cucumber wheels. Wen holds 1 cucumber slice up and looks at Andrew and Eric. The rind was peeled off, the way she likes it. Andrew says, "Go ahead. You can eat." She eats everything on her plate, grim and determined to complete the task. She will later leave the table with a faint chocolate milk mustache coloring her lip. The three others are seated at the table. Leonard and Sabrina praise Adrian for how moist the chicken is. Single word delicious declaratives and "I didn't think I was hungry" are passed around the table along with the pepper, barbecue sauce, and raspberry balsamic dressing. Busy knives and forks clink and scrape on the plates. Andrew seethes, boiling with incredulity and despair. How can the others simply engage in go through the dinner motions as though nothing is wrong? How do they so easily ignore the horror of what has happened and the expanding horror of what is happening and what will happen? Adrian mumbles about how a beer would hit the spot and then laughs. No one else laughs with her. Andrew says, "Hey, go ahead. Help yourselves to the 12-pack in the bottom drawer of the fridge. Make sure to recycle after." Adrian says, "Really?" and looks at Sabrina and Leonard for a reaction. "Nah, that's all right." She raises her glass of water. Maybe some other time. She takes a big sip and wipes her face with both hands.
Eric notices that none of the others said grace or a prayer before the meal. He anticipated and hoped they would.
If they said grace, he might have learned about what God they believe is the source of their visions and is ultimately the motivation behind them being here. Maybe Eric would have been able to use that information to better engage them in a conversation about their faith and possibly persuade them into letting his family go.
He was so sure that grace was going to happen. Eric thinks he might have zoned out and missed it. Or the prayer happened and he witnessed it and promptly forgot it because of his concussion.
That he hasn't even spied one of the others performing a quick, furtive sign of the cross doesn't make sense to him.
After they finish eating, Leonard asks Wen to help with dinner for her dad's. He says it's a super important job.
I don't think they'll eat without you.
Wen wordlessly agrees to help. She stands in front of Eric with a fork in her hand. Leonard carries over a plate of cut-up chicken and a leaf pile of salad. Sabrina patiently details a set of instructions for all to follow. Wen spears a piece of chicken on a plastic fork and holds it in front of Eric's face. He opens his mouth only wide enough to let the chicken pass through. It's lukewarm. He doesn't linger, doesn't allow himself the luxury of taste, and chews and swallows quickly. Wen doesn't talk, doesn't ask if he wants chicken again next or a cherry tomato. She doesn't look at his eyes, only his mouth. She doesn't stop feeding him until Eric says,
"That's enough for me, sweetie. Thank you."
She puts the fork on the plate and then holds up a cup of water. Andrew wants to tell the others to fuck off, that he doesn't want anything from them. He imagines accepting the first bite and spitting it into one of their faces. But when his daughter stands in front of him, so intently doing her job, he loses his resolve and eats everything that is offered. Post-dinner, there's cleanup and more cartoons on the television. Sabrina plays game after game of solitaire at the kitchen table. Adrian disinterestedly flips through the book Eric brought and goes out onto the front stoop to smoke cigarettes. She asks if anyone has a jigsaw puzzle. She says that's what her mom always used to do when they went on vacation. Leonard asks Wen questions about what she's watching. If it's a yes or no question, she answers.
Do you like this show?
Yes.
Have you seen this one before?
No. Any question inviting a more detailed response yields a shrug or a thousand-yard stare. Eric is exhausted and has a difficult time keeping his eyes open. He attempts to get the others talking about the visions, avoiding explicit references to God and the Bible because of his own growing unease. The why of the apocalyptic choice, the why of the whole thing. But none of them bite. Sabrina says,
"We'll talk about it tomorrow, after you and your family have slept on it."
Andrew tries a different tact, periodically asking to be untied, successive requests becoming more elaborate and ridiculous.
"How about you untie me so I can fix the kitchen table leg? I noticed the playing cards sliding off the edge there, and really, the table shouldn't be propped up on magical realists. You know, there's a lumber yard not too far away, and I can go pick up some wood, whittle it into a new leg in no time. I guess I'd have to stop somewhere and get some white paint, but that's not a big deal. I don't mind. I'd already be out."
Andrew figures if they take him less seriously because of his barrage of increasingly untenable requests, all the better for when he makes the serious attempt at breaking free, and then to the SUV and his gun. Leonard announces,
"It's getting late. We could all use the rest, and we'll be up with the sun."
He gathers the towels and curtain off the floor. Then the three others drag the mattresses out of the bedrooms. There's enough space for the queen size to be sandwiched between two singles from the bunk beds. With the television turned off, and Wen already changed into pajamas and having washed up and brushed her teeth, Andrew and Eric are again taken to the bathroom separately.
Wen sits with Leonard on the couch next to the sledgehammer weapon.
Adrian repositions Andrew's and Eric's chairs to either side of the front door. Their shoulders brush against the wall as their arms are slipped behind the chair backs. Sabrina and Adrian tie the men's legs to the chair legs, and Sabrina apologizes, saying they can't trust that the two of them will sleep on the mattresses and remain tied. She says they'll try to make sleeping while sitting up as comfortable as possible.
It's going to be a cold night in the cabin. The temperature has already dropped into the high 50s.
Adrian builds a fire in the wood-burning stove, but the heat rapidly dissipates through the porous screen slider. Thin blankets are pulled over Andrew's and Eric's chests and tucked between their shoulders and the wall, pillows stuffed behind their heads and necks. Andrew doesn't say anything, and is confident he'll be able to break free from the ropes after the others are asleep. Eric is spent, and the warm, soft pillow enveloping his head is a potent soporific. He's in a half-awake, half-asleep state before the lights are turned out. Andrew and Eric are allowed a goodnight kiss with Wen. They smile and repeatedly say her name with every known inflection, attempting to let her know they will still protect her and keep her safe, despite all evidence to the contrary. They tell her she is brave and doing so well, and they love her more than anything in the world. She has seen so much and heard so much and done so much. They do not dare imagine reliving the events of this day through the prism of Wen. She is non-responsive, an automaton following a basic program of breathing, blinks, and sluggish limb movements. Wen is funneled to the queen-sized mattress without struggle or fuss. She lies down, burrowing into the blankets, taking up as little space as possible, adrift on the sea of foam. Leonard proffers her stuffed animal pig, Corey, her favorite, and she pulls it into her chest with all the enthusiasm of a student accepting a math test from her teacher. Sabrina and Adrian crawl onto the smaller bunk mattresses. Leonard stretches out on the couch. No one moves or adjusts their resting positions for hours, seemingly. Andrew remains awake and quietly struggles to loosen the ropes on his hands and wrists, which have gone numb from being pinned behind his back for so long. It's cold, still and quiet in the cabin, but for the occasional crackle and hiss from the wood-burning stove. The bathroom light is the only light on, and the door is shut, so there is only a weak yellow glow tracing its outline. Outside, a cloudless night sky and a bright crescent moon lord over the lake. Andrew can now see Redmond's covered body on the deck just fine. He can't help but wonder if he stays up all night, will he see a wild animal, or are there any other kind, crawl up the deck stairs and investigate what's underneath the blanket. Unable to make any progress with the ropes, he whispers, "Eric, hey, are you awake? Eric, hey." Adrian says, "There are people trying to sleep."
"Keep trying, and you fuckers aren't people. I'm going to talk to my husband,"
Andrew says in a stern talking voice that might as well be a shout in the nocturnal silence and calm. Eric says,
"I'm awake now."
Eric and Andrew share a rapid-fire whispered conversation. Eric is murky with sleep and doubt. Andrew is manic and self-aware that his desperation is apparent, as audible as a creaking door in an empty house.
"Are you okay, Eric? Are you feeling any better?" "Yeah, a little better, I think. My brain doesn't feel three sizes too small for my skull anymore. Maybe one size." "I know you're not feeling great, and I wanted to make sure you noticed the first earthquake, the one up near Alaska, happened 4 hours before they turned on the TV."
"Was it that long?"
"Yes, that's what they said on the news. Remember? Hawaii had all that lead time to evacuate. Remember the empty resort?"
"Okay, I guess, yeah, that sounds right."
"It is right. Trust me on that. And did you see how often Leonard checked his watch?"
"Maybe. I can't really remember. I think so. He checked it like 1,000 times. I saw some of the others checking the time, too, which means the time was important to them. They didn't start any of it until the time was right. Leonard even said something about the time being right. He did. He definitely did.
Yeah, okay. I think I remember that. You know they can hear us, even though we're whispering, right?
Sabrina says, yeah, we can hear you, and...
I know, and I don't care. I'm not talking to any of you.
So, they knew about the first earthquake and Hawaii tsunami before they came out to the cabin. Think about it. They didn't get any visions or prophecies. They knew about the Alaska quake and of the imminent tsunami before they got here. They had that shit in their pockets with them when they came out here.
Sure, makes sense. Why are you telling me this?
Because I know you, and I don't want you to be spooked by them lying about getting visions and predicting the earthquake and the apocalypse.
Leonard says, that's enough. Guys, please.
Andrew and Eric continue as though no one else is speaking. No one else is there.
You really think I believe them?
No, I don't know. I just wanted to make sure, with your bad fall and everything, that you could see what they were doing, how they targeted us, and how they're trying to break us down and manipulate us. How they knew about the earthquake before they came to the cabin, and how that second earthquake was just a coincidence set off by the first one, right? And how all the Goonies bullshit was bullshit. And you saw how they reacted when the second earthquake hit, like they won the fucking lottery, and...
Oh my God, you do think I might believe them. Are you serious with this?
There's a hesitation, an empty space filled with silent words.
No, I don't think that. I'm sorry, don't get mad. I'm not trying to make you mad. Please, I'm sorry, I'm just scared. And I wanted to make sure that, you know...
Yeah, I know. Don't worry about me. I don't believe them.
I know you don't, I know you don't.
I don't.
Sabrina says, that's enough. Please, we all need to sleep.
Hey, Eric? Still here.
I'm sorry. And I love you.
I love you too.
There's another beat of silence that both men want to fill, but don't know how they possibly could. Then Andrew says,
hey, can you guys untie me? I want to keep the fire in the stove going all night. Don't worry, I won't fall asleep on the job, I promise, and I'll go outside and gather more wood.
Adrian says, shut up, or we'll shut you up. Put, like, gags over your mouth or something.
Leonard says, easy, Adrian. It's okay. Everyone is good, everyone is fine. We can all go back to sleep now.
Leonard prattles on in a low voice, and Sabrina joins in with empty, we won't hurt you avowals.
Eric is stung by Andrew thinking that he might, even in the smallest of ways, believe the others are telling some version of the truth.
It stings because Andrew would be more than a little correct in thinking that. Eric's fear gives way temporarily to shame and anger, and it leaks out as he says,
if any of you attempt to put something over my mouth, I'll bite your fingers off.
Then he silently prays for God to help them.
Wen. In Wen's bedroom back home, there's a nightlight plugged into the wall across from her bed. It has a simple white bulb that isn't shaped like a cartoon character or a comic book hero or an animal or the moon or anything in particular. She likes it that way. She doesn't want any funny shapes because funny shapes make scary shadows. In addition to the nightlight, she insists the hallway light stay on as well, and the bathroom light too, with the door open. Her parents have tried to wean her off sleeping with lights on, explaining her still-growing brain needs the dark for proper rest. Wen once told them she doesn't want her brain growing too fast for her head anyway. Sometimes, after she falls asleep, one of her parents shuts off the bathroom light, the hall light, or, gasp, both. She thinks it must be Daddy Eric, because he always complains about her and Daddy Andrew leaving lights on everywhere in the condo, wasting electricity. But she has yet to catch him in the act. Shutting off the bathroom light is a grievous betrayal, and it once angered her enough to announce at the breakfast table that she will have a terrible day. When her parents asked why, she dramatically pouted and said, "You know why," and then couldn't hide her snarky smirk in the brightness of the kitchen. Wen is sitting up on the mattress without the memory of waking. She looks around, moving only her eyes at first. She doesn't move her head until she's convinced everyone else is asleep. It's dark, but less dark than it should be with almost no lights on in the cabin. The bathroom light doesn't count as being on because the door is shut. She wonders if anything happened while she was asleep. She wonders if it's possible she slept through an entire day, and it's now the next night instead of the same one. Wen slips out of her blankets and crawls to the edge of the mattress. If this were another evening under different circumstances, she would jump mattress to mattress, pretending they were rafts in a vast cold sea. Or the mattresses were rocks, stubbornly maintaining their life-saving heft and shape within a bubbling lava flow. Instead, she's careful to not disturb Sabrina. She sleeps on her back with her arms over her head, dangling off the mattress, her mouth open slightly. And Adrian. She sleeps rolled up into a ball, like she's hiding because she's mad at everyone in the room. Only the top half of her head sticks out from under her blanket, exposed to the cool night air. To her left are the screen slider and deck. The blanket covering Redmond ripples in a breeze like it's considering a transformation into a wing and flying away. She wonders what Redmond looks like now. Is he all broken and mashed up, squished like a stepped-on caterpillar? Or does he look the same as he did before, but like he is sleeping? She's never seen a dead body before. She has asked adults what a dead body looks like, and the only one who somewhat answered her was Daddy Andrew. He told her a dead body looked like the person, but not like them at the same time, because there was something missing. She joked, "Like a nose or an ear?" And he laughed. Wen never felt more proud of herself as when she made one of her dad's laugh. She asked him to explain what he meant, and Daddy Andrew pretended, she knew he was pretending, and she hated when he did this to her, with loud hmms, a finger tapping his lips, chin rubs and other, "I don't really want to answer this," stalling tactics. She thought he was never going to explain further, but she played it smart. She didn't press, didn't whine, didn't demand. She waited him out. She waited until he shrank down a little under her stare, and he smiled the "you win" smile. He said that the dead bodies he saw reminded him of slightly deflated birthday balloons, ones that hung around limply a day or two after the party. She didn't like the answer and wanted to ask him more, but he said, "Don't tell Eric we were talking about dead bodies, all right?" Wen doesn't think Redmond would look like a balloon. Even though she didn't see any of it, she knows they hit him repeatedly with the weapons, and she did see all the blood after, and she could smell it. She heard him screaming. She heard it all, and she can hear it now if she lets herself, those awful hollow thumps and the final wet crack that shook the floor and her legs. But what if it sounded worse than it was, and he just got hurt badly and was knocked out like Daddy Eric? What if Redmond is alive and he wakes up? What if he's awake now and waiting for someone to come outside, or he's waiting for her to make a run for it, and he'll reach out and grab her and pull her underneath the blanket, and she'll be stuck there with him forever? She whispers, "No," to make herself look away from the deck and Redmond. She crawls on all fours to the end table, pushed up against the wall next to the bathroom. The yellow lamp looks black, like it's its own shadow. She reaches up and tries to turn it on. 2-3 clicks of the spinning switch, and it doesn't work. "Hey, Wen?" It's Leonard. "What's up?"
He sounds like he's right behind her, and his shadow is heavier than a lead blanket, the kind they put over her chest for when she had x-rays. And she freezes with her hand on the lamp, willing herself to fade into the darkness of the night room. Leonard is not right behind her. He sits up on the couch. The springs groan under his weight. He asks,
"Do you have to go to the bathroom?"
Wen shakes her head. He says,
"It's okay."
Nothing is okay. She knows this. Wen shouldn't say anything to him. She knows this, too. But she can't help it. She whispers, "I want a light. I always go to sleep with a light on." He says,
"Come back to bed, and I'll tell you why we didn't leave one on for you."
There's an echo inside of her, coming from far enough away that the speaker cannot be identified. It might be her voice. It might be one or both of her dad's, or a mix, or someone else entirely. This voice repeats what Daddy Andrew said to her earlier. The voice tells her to run, to go onto the deck and never mind about Redmond, because he's not getting up ever again.
"Run now. Go outside and run and hide. Don't be afraid of the dark out there. Be afraid of what's happening inside and what will happen inside."
It says,
"This is your only chance. Now, 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 now."
She can't. And in her head, she tells the voice she's sorry. Wen stands up, moving like a sunrise. She considers sitting with one of her dad's, but they are both asleep, their heads slumped forward. She walks the short distance back to her mattress and disappears under the blankets, remaining with her head covered. Her pillow is cold against her face. Leonard says,
"We didn't leave any lights on, because it's better for Eric's head. He needs sleep, and he needs it dark for his head to get better."
Why do adults keep telling her that dark makes heads better? She thinks they're lying, and that they lie way more than any kid ever does.
Wen flips over and faces Leonard. He has his blanket pulled up to his chin, so he's only a big head.
She says, "How do you know?"
"Sabrina told me, and she's a nurse. The light hurts his head, so after he sleeps in the dark, he'll feel much better in the morning."
"He will?"
"Yes, I promise."
Another lie, but it's one she wants to believe. She says, "Then you'll make us choose again."
"I won't make you, but I will ask. I have to."
"Please don't."
"I'm sorry, but I have to."
"I can't be friends with you."
"I know, and I'm sorry. I have no choice."
"Who is making you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Who is making you do this to us?"
"God."
Leonard says the one-syllable word sheepishly, and he has a strange look on his face. Speaking the word aloud brings him both great relief and terror.
There's a boy at Wen's school who talked about God all the time and insisted that his God was a he. That boy was annoying, and Wen avoided playing with him whenever she could. Daddy Andrew makes it a point to tell her about all kinds of religions and gods from around the world. There are so many it's confusing, but she enjoys listening to the different stories, even if some of them frighten her. She knows that Daddy Eric believes in a god, and that he even goes to church by himself sometimes on Sunday mornings. He doesn't invite Wen or Daddy Andrew to go with him, and he doesn't seem to like to talk about his god or religion, so she doesn't ever ask him. It's almost like it's this secret Daddy Eric keeps under his bed instead of the old pictures. Wen isn't sure what she believes in, and sometimes that fills her with anxiety and a desire to simply choose a random religion like someone might choose to become a fan of a sports team because of the mascot or the color of the uniform. She says, "I don't believe you. Why do you keep lying to me?
It's the truth.
I think you're wrong.
I wish I was.
I wish more than anything. Why would God make you do this?
Leonard sighs and shifts around under his blanket.
I'm not sure.
I'm not. That's the truth, Wen. It's something I've thought a lot about. But I can't do anything to change it, if that makes sense.
Wen blinks, and sudden and surprising tears fall from her eyes. She says,
It doesn't make sense.
I don't think it's supposed to. We're not supposed to make sense of it. We're just supposed to do.
Your God is a killer, then.
Wen, no, it's not like...
And if we don't choose, then something else bad is going to happen? Like another terrible earthquake?
Not another earthquake. But yes, something very bad.
And a lot of people will die?
People will die.
I don't believe you. And I wish you would stop making this all up.
I can promise you one thing, Wen.
What?
Your parents won't ever choose to sacrifice you. I know they won't. And I wouldn't let them do anything to you. I would stop them. I would protect you if I had to. That's my promise. You shouldn't be worried about that.
Sacrifice means die, right?
Yes, but one of your dads will be saving the rest of the world, Wen. Think about how many people out there.
I don't want any of us to die, ever.
Wen sinks back under the blanket, covering her head. Leonard whispers her name, trying to coax her back out. She can't help but imagine her dad's as saggy balloons stuck in this cabin and never able to float away. She makes a deal with this killer god of Leonard's, a god she doesn't believe is real, but is very much frightened of. She has this image of his god as all the black, empty space between stars when you look up at the night sky. And this god of collected blankness is big enough to swallow the moon, the earth, the sun, the Milky Way, and big enough it couldn't possibly care about anyone or anything. Still, she asks this god if she and her parents can please leave the cabin. Can they please go home and be safe? And if it lets them, she promises she won't ever complain about sleeping in the dark with the lights off. Ever again.
Eric. In the morning, the others scurry around the kitchen, making placemats out of paper towels, and setting glasses and mugs on the table. They are purposeful, determined, and clearly anxious. The surreal, relaxed family on vacation vibe from last night's dinner is gone. If one of them was to accidentally brush up against the other, there'd be a bright and loud static electric spark, which would then set off an explosion. Sabrina asks them all twice if they want coffee and how much. She obsessively glances out the small window above the sink to the deck, from which wafts a putrid, tangy, many days old garbage smell. Leonard checks his watch, claps his hands together and says,
Okay,
to himself. Adrian stacks buttered browned toast onto a plate, and she shoos and mutters at the stubborn gaggle of flies buzzing the food.
Get out. Get the fuck out.
Wen sits at the kitchen table with the others, but doesn't speak to anyone. She looks down into her lap, and her hands are clenched into fists, her thumbs cocooned inside. Andrew tells her it's all right to eat. Wen doesn't eat or drink anything, even when offered chocolate milk. Andrew tells her if she doesn't feel like eating right now, that's okay too. Eric adds,
Whatever you want to do.
Which, given their current circumstances, is an unintentionally cruel thing to say. Wen deflates and sags into the kitchen chair, so only the top of her head is visible above the table. Andrew and Eric loudly refuse offers of toast and water in solidarity. Eric's head doesn't hurt like it did the day before,
though he is far from fully recovered from his concussion. His head is an overstuffed washing machine, wobbling off its track in the spin cycle. The room is too brightly lit when it isn't bright for anyone else. His throat is dry, and he regrets not drinking water when offered. He's exhausted and struggles to remain awake, even as the rest of his body screams and begs to be released from the prison of its sitting position. His arms and legs ache, although the restraints have perceptibly slackened over the long night. He's now able to pull his hands apart so they are no longer touching, and he can stretch his lower legs a centimeter or two away from the chair. Small, but significant progress. He wonders if the ropes around Andrew have loosened as well. After the hurried breakfast, Sabrina checks Eric's dressing and wound. She says it doesn't look great, and perhaps could have used a few stitches after all, but it isn't infected. The others carry the blankets and mattresses out of the common room. They move quickly and efficiently, stagehands making short work of a scene change. Leonard drags Andrew, still tied to the chair, away from the front door and into the center of the room. The wooden chair legs scrape and screech across the floor, as percussive as a passing tractor trailer on a highway, leaving gouged parallel lines in the wood. When Leonard comes for Eric and his chair, Eric says, "No, please. Dragging me like that will not be good for my head. I'm feeling better, but not that much better. Untie my legs, and I'll walk. I promise I'll be good." Eric is an inept liar, and always has been. Leonard towers above, as large and solemn as an Easter Island statue. He says, "Sorry, not yet." He retucks his white shirt into his jeans, then bends and reaches for the chair's armrests. "Hey, let's pick him up. Carry him instead. We can help you. We need him to be thinking clearly, more clearly than he was thinking yesterday, right?" Sabrina jogs over and stands next to Eric and his chair. Adrian comes over too. Leonard says, "We don't have much time." But he acquiesces after a brief negotiation. The three of them lift Eric and his chair a few inches off the ground. He wobbles and pitches as they readjust, overcorrect, and shuffle carry him. Eric considers twisting or leaning all his weight to one side, so they might drop him, for no strategic reason other than he can, for the moment, control what will happen to him. They set him down with Andrew to his right, the same area of the room in which he was moored yesterday. Having been returned to this spot is more than a little demoralizing, and it's as though Eric's dizziness and low-grade nausea is the result of time travel. Wen is on the couch. Eric didn't witness her relocation from the kitchen table. Did she walk there on her own, or was she carried too? A blanket is pulled over her legs. Andrew is trying to get her attention and asks if she is cold, if she's all right, if she wants to sit with him or Eric. She doesn't answer, and stares ahead blankly, as though witnessing the horror awaiting their near futures. The others pace around the room, searching for something they forgot to prepare properly. They circle like carrion birds, squawking and muttering. Each asks the others how they feel and if they're ready. One of them says, "I can't believe we have to go through this again." And another one says, "I know." And another, "This is so hard." And another, "I don't know if I can." And another, "You can." And another, "We can and we must." And another, "This isn't like a bad dream, but I wish it was." And another, "It's real, the realest thing I've ever done." And another, "Let's just get it over with." And another, "We have to do it right." And another, "We owe it to them." And another, "Give them a chance to save us all." Their repositioning within the room shifts on some unseen, unheard cue. Adrian steps up between Eric and Andrew. Leonard and Sabrina retreat into the background. Leonard says, "I didn't do a very good job of presenting the choice yesterday.
Leonard looks at his watch and then looks everywhere else in the room but at Wen.
You'll be great, Adrian, I know it.
Adrian rolls her eyes and says, Gee, thanks, boss. So, yeah, here we are again.
Leonard and Sabrina gather the same weaponized wooden staffs they used the day before. They are held with purpose, with the confidence of already having been wielded properly and successfully.
Adrian is empty-handed. Propped against the wood-burning stove, her cleaned weapon is a rustic decoration, something from an alternate bygone era, impractical as it is improbable.
Adrian says, We...
She pauses to look over her shoulder at Sabrina, who nods encouragement.
Are here to present you with the same choice you had yesterday.
Eric says, Look, we're powerless here. It's you three that have a choice, and a chance to do the right thing and let us go. You know letting us go is the right thing to do. You all seem like nice people who honestly don't want to be doing what you're doing. And the good news is, you do not have to do this, any of this.
Eric feels more in control, feels more like himself, and the nagging echo of the vision of the figure in light he saw yesterday is more easily dismissed as a hallucination, or perhaps a visual symptom of an acute ocular migraine, something that he has suffered in the past.
Adrian twitches and rubs her arms, clearly uncomfortable speaking for the group.
No, we do have to. We don't have a choice, not like you. Even if we wanted to let you go, we can't.
It wouldn't fly, man. We wouldn't be allowed to.
Eric focuses on Adrian's fidgeting, empty hands, and with her weapon across the room, it occurs to him that she is next. He almost says aloud, You will be next. If he, Eric, and Wen again choose not to sacrifice any one of themselves, then the other two will kill Adrian ritualistically with their weapons, like they killed Redmond yesterday.
Does he have it correct?
It feels right, but it doesn't make any sense, and at some point they would have to stop killing each other, wouldn't they?
So, you guys have the same choice to make, and you have to make it now, same as yesterday. Same deal, right? I mean, you saw what happened on the West Coast.
Adrian points at the television, her outstretched arm reflected in the black screen.
How could you not believe us after watching all those people drown? We told you it was coming, and when you didn't make the choice, all those people died and died screaming. How could you see that and not...
Andrew screams, For fuck's sake! And thrashes around in his chair.
None of that had anything to do with us or you.
Eric says, Purely a coincidence.
The lack of conviction in his voice is obvious. So obvious, the three others look at him as though they're seeing him for the first time, as though they've made a discovery.
Andrew says, No, it was not a coincidence, it wasn't. You knew the Alaskan earthquake had happened already, before you came out to the cabin. And there was the tsunami warning, and you planned your little visit here accordingly.
Sabrina says, That's not true.
So, tell us what's going to be on TV this morning. I know it's almost time for something Leonard wants to see, because he keeps checking his watch, just like he did yesterday. You know, I never realized the end of the world would be kept to such a tight, regimented TV guide schedule. This is enough! This is insane! You're all insane!
Adrian shouts, You need to calm right the fuck down and think for a second! Sabrina leans forward and speaks to Eric. As, to his shame, he's now been identified as the one who might believe them.
Even if we knew about the earthquake in the hours before we came here, why and how did we end up even coming here in the first place? I mean, how did the four of us strangers from different parts of the country know to randomly meet in the middle of nowhere, New Hampshire?
It was because we had visions. We're sent here. We're told to.
Andrew shouts over her. So you're admitting you knew about the earthquake before you got to the cabin?
Yes, I mean, no. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. Adrian says. It doesn't matter. You have another chance to stop more people from dying by making the choice. You and us and everyone on the fucking planet will run out of chances if you don't choose to.